Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, we'll experienced strategist, designer, and artist, Chow Do.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Davey Nathan. I am Mark Leisure, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
One day my brother Peter was talking to me. I don't know if this was during his MBA studies or because he had already been a consultant before he went to get his MBA, or if it was afterwards when he was working at a V-level suite in a corporation, or working as a consultant with one of the top 1% of the corporations in the world. But he, who had been in this field and who is brilliant, mainly in the HR and corporate structure studies and also business consulting, said to me, you know, corporations, they're not getting this. And he says the cake lady thing, like he was trying to figure out how to talk to people about this, how to talk to corporations about how important this was. And I said, the cake lady, what's the cake lady? And he said, it's not the cake lady. Nobody calls it the cake lady, but it makes sense if you put that on it, the cake lady. And so I wanted further explanation. I was interested. And he started to share with me, he said, there was a corporation that needed to downsize. So they decided to get rid of their lower producing sales reps and only keep the high producing, high functioning, top achievers that were bringing in the majority of the money. And so they got rid of the ones that weren't quote unquote producing or bringing in money. And so now the corporation's support was going only to the high achievers. The resources were going only to the high achievers. And instead of sales going up and instead of sales staying the same, sales went down and morale went down. And I probably interrupted at the time. It was many, many years ago. I don't know. I might have actually shared this story on the Life Changes Show, and I'll say why I'm saying that in a little bit. But because I asked my brother permission a long time ago, I don't remember if I ever used the story. But I thought morale went down, and that's what brought the sales down. And my brother said, no, they fired the cake lady. And I'm like, the cake lady, what's the cake lady? He said, you know, there's always somebody in the office or a couple somebodies. And back when, it used to be usually a mom who had kids who was quick to make cakes and cookies for their kids' birthdays, or was able to, you know, make cakes for or cookies for bake sales and stuff, would bring in a cake for somebody's birthday, would be the one to always ask, how are you? How's your wife? How's your kids? How's your husband? Whatever it is. And somebody who cared, that cake lady. So they didn't just fire the people that weren't not producing, quote unquote, they fired the cake lady. That was his whole thing, trying to get, how do we get the corporations to understand how important the cake lady is? So if I mentioned the story on the show before, I probably would have ended with the moral is, and what was my takeaway, and part of what I got from what my brother was sharing, was that you don't fire the cake lady, actually. No, but you have to keep morale high, and you find out who that person is, and then you keep them or something. Even if they're not producing, quote unquote, sales, they're doing something. Their job is important. So I probably would have ended there. But this is 2026. Now I'm thinking, don't just not fire the cake person. Give them a raise.
That really takes the cake.
There, I said it, and you said it.
It's inspiring, and you bring it full circle to in my mind to community, and how we show up for each other and the kind of experiences that we create even in our office settings.
Especially, and our guest inspired me sharing or resharing this story because she's going to talk with us about the frequencies we hold and we share in relationships, family, in the workplace.
All of it. It's all connected. I'm so excited for tonight. Both of these guests are amazing, amazing friends, amazing talents. I have a feeling they'll end up collaborating. we met Chow through Natalie Bonin and the biometric study and Dr. Mitch, past guests as well. And there's kind of bigger things that we've all been doing around the immersive space and her musical prowess and the whole experiential biometric study is just incredible in terms of starting to understand what's really happening during different types of behaviors or trainings.
And she's a data collector. So not only what's really happening, how we could use it for the benefit of all. And so, of course, we're talking about our interview guest, who is Chow Do. And we're also talking about our performance guest, who is Davey Nathan. And we've titled this episode, How to Bridge Wellness, Design, and Human Connection in the Workplace, since that's something that's probably not very well or often addressed. This is episode 877 of the Life Changes Show. And our guest is an experienced strategist. She's a designer, an artist, a consultant, and founder of Chaos Kura. Chaos.Kura. We'll learn more about that in a little bit. She is Chow Do. Welcome, Chow, to the Life Changes Show.
Hi, how's it going?
What do you think? I think it's going great already.
I love your story. I feel like we need to pay the cake lady for her cake and all the effort. I totally agree with you.
That's true, too. That, didn't think of that. That is true, too.
What a great story. I think it's so resonating in terms of community, because essentially the workplace is just another community that we embody and we spend a lot of time with. So how do we take what we already do in community and bring it into the workplace as well?
So you inspired this because of some of the stories you were sharing, and it reminded me of that. And we don't necessarily recognize how important our energy is when we walk into a room or the workplace, or if we shouldn't bring our energy to the workplace, or who's bringing what, right?
Yeah. And even before that, just the level of self-awareness of what's okay and what's not. I feel like traditionally workplace has always been, there's a perception of what do you do at work? What's okay to talk about at work? But I do feel like that has shifted a lot with younger generations demanding the work, their workplace to represent their values, to be able to show up authentically and bring more of their personal life to work. So you're starting to see a huge shift between what does that mean?
Well, and so you bring so much to this space, and I was inspired by that as well and excited because you come from a background that dovetails so beautifully, or complements, I should say, without, I don't think most of us even knowing this. So we'll get into that. Let's just start with, not very many people had a childhood like you.
Yes, I was born in China, and I grew up with my grandfather, who when he retired, he turned our home into a free community healing center. He learned traditional Eastern medicine, and anyone around us that wasn't feeling well would come over to our house. And I remember being 4 years old and pulling acupuncture needles out of people, feeling like it was really fun, and burning newspaper to put into these jars so we can do cupping on people. So growing up in that environment just kind of really created a grounding for what does community mean for me?
Wow. And what about early mornings and meditation?
Yeah, so in addition to traditional Chinese medicine, he also learned Buddhism. So growing up with him, I remember every morning he would take me to the hill behind us to go for a morning hike and watch the sunrise together. And when we come off the hill, we would meditate. So there's just a lot of different healing modalities within the culture itself and Buddhism that I was raised with.
Now, were you meditating, or what were you doing, or what did you think you were doing, or did you know what you were doing?
That's a great question. It was hard for a child to sit and be still. So a lot of it was struggling, I feel like trying to be still, listen to your body and just being. So I think it was a lot of struggling. That's what was happening early on.
Wow. Well, obviously something worked because here you are. And then you shared something fascinating with me about the Mandarin language. How, yes.
As an adult, I started reflecting back to the language itself, and I realized the entire language is built around energy, which is qi. For instance, when you're eating anything, items will either give you hot qi or cold qi, or there's some neutral ones. When you talk about the weather, it's tian qi, which is sky's energy. So even if you're describing weather and externally, you're still describing just the energy of the environment. And the third thing was, I remember my dad would always say, when he wants to compliment someone, he will pause and say that person has qi zhi, which means high quality qi. So it was just interesting to reflect back and realize everything is built around that.
Do you feel that you've been influenced by that coming to the States and sensing the energy or and how we need to focus more on energy?
That's a great question. So I moved away from China when I was 10, came to the US, that went to elementary and middle school here, and then moved to Singapore for high school and came back. So I think moving around the world has actually, I felt a little bit disconnected from all of this growing up, going to college and started to work to the point of burnout, which is why it forced me to kind of pause and reflect on what I used to know, right? And now, getting back into these healing modalities, I'm starting to realize and getting more in touch with my roots.
So interestingly enough, it somewhere on one of your writings with me, you shared something about no, there's knowing and then there's experiential knowing. So potentially what you learned as a child, you it was in there, but then you added your adult understanding of it, or how did that come together?
Definitely. I think what you're taught as your primary language and environment really forces, well, not forces, but it really frames your processing, right? The language itself, the way you write it are all pictographs. So they're little diagrams and drawings. The language you speak is around built around energy. So there's a lot of understanding from the original culture. And then learning the English and the whole different way of thinking and processing is interesting to be able to hold both and be able to be fluid and I guess go back and forth. And the quote you're referencing, which is something that's really stuck with me, is knowledge is a rumor until it lives in the body.
That's it. Yes.
That really, yeah, that's been really resonating with me. Attributed to the Asaro tribe in Papua New Guinea, but I just felt like there's so much about intellectual knowledge to embodied experiences. And I feel like once you embody it and experience it, you might not do it for a while, but you never truly forget it. It always lives within you.
Awesome. That breaking point that you talk about, that actually wasn't very long ago, right?
No, it wasn't that long ago.
What was going on at the time?
It was during the pandemic, and I think a lot of people hit that breaking point. Being pressured, to shift from being outside connecting with people to being at home all the time. So the breaking point was when the pandemic started. I was working on the Dream Project as an interior designer, and when we transitioned to working from home, taking calls, everybody was learning what to do. But essentially, it became back to back, and I think a lot of people experience this: nonstop calls for 8 to 10 hours a day, and you're not even able to get up or move around. So literally, my body was just frozen in the same spot all day long, and started breaking apart. Getting carpal tunnel syndromes and gaining 20 to 20 something pounds. So to a point where a friend of mine looked at me, he's like, "You're too young to be breaking apart. Like this is not okay." And that really hit me to say, yeah, we can work until, to a breaking point, but what does it all mean? So it really forced me to start reflecting on what does wellness mean for me?
You brought up something really interesting, and we were talking about a specific client of mine actually, and our conversation went someplace that is very real to so many people today, and that is there are the people that stay at home and potentially they don't spend as much time working or something like that. I don't know. That's not me, so I don't even know how that's possible, but I'm sure it's possible. But then what I'm gathering from what you're saying and what I've experienced and what I think a lot of people may have experienced is we end up working at home a lot more, and not just during those 8 hours, because yeah, it's easy to book back to back because you're just sitting there. You don't have to, but then on adding to that, there, we have texts and we have emails that we can turn on at 2 o'clock in the morning, or somebody will text us at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Can you do such and such? That didn't used to exist.
Right. We are so connected and overstimulated. We're the first, if you think about it, we've never had this much access to each other, right? And what does that mean? I was watching an older movie, from the early 2000s, and it was such a slow speed, and the way people lived, it calmed my nervous system. And I think a lot of people nowadays are just feeling so overwhelmed with, like you said, text messages, emails, social media, and other people feeling like they should have access to you, right? If they can send a message to your phone and you're using your phone all the time, you should be able to respond. So I think there's a lot of confusion on what's okay, what are the norms, what are the boundaries. And I think everyone is still trying to figure that out.
We're
I know
waiting for you to write
I am.
am.
To be continued.
To be continued, indeed. So I think another thing that you brought into the conversation that I found brilliant also is that there are so many things, like, as I'm going to say, as some people are going back into the workplace, like some people are not, and maybe never will, I don't know. But as some people are in a workplace, there are some environments where they'll set up like a play or a quiet area or something like that. But you were saying what? That sometimes though those don't work because what?
Oh, yeah. So what I've noticed is that pre-pandemic, a lot of the workplaces were what it was. And there's a certain expectation about what did you do at work. And from our research, we referenced the work modes a lot. So that would include focus, collaboration, socialize, learn, and rejuvenation. And rejuvenation, as we're sending this data set to really understand how organizations and people work, rejuvenation was always the lowest, most of the time less than 5%, and generally less than 2%. So I think what happened is a lot of during the pandemic, a lot of people were able to go home, and depending on where they're located in the world or even in the country and their home environment, a lot of people were able to find their own rhythm into what works best for them, right? When can you take a break? When can you unplug? What kind of food and access you had, and et cetera. So now corporations are trying to bring people back into the office. And once people have experienced control, to whatever level they can, it's really hard to go back to being overstimulated and people have access to you all the time. Like we were saying, even being at home, you have access on phone, email, text message. But imagine that, and then going back to the in-person experience. So there's a lot of exposure and overstimulation. And I think what we were talking about is that some corporations are looking at how do we add wellness spaces, right? Even a room for you to go in and relax for a little bit, rejuvenation and stasis. But when leaders, if the culture of the organization doesn't really allow for the space to really be activated, for instance, if the leaders never use it, then is it okay for me to go to the rest space for a little bit? How will other people feel? And this is why we talk about the work experience, not just the workplace or the work culture. They all have to work together to really create that holistic experience.
I would think this is a really big field. Like you have a really big job in this century.
It's a problem we all been trying to solve for a long time, just human behavior and organizational behavior.
It's fascinating, and the elements that you're bringing in from your upbringing and your studies and your personal experiences obviously all lead to that. And speaking of personal experiences, I thought it was your job to collect the data and analyze your data, the data with the biometrics and all this stuff that you're doing with Natalie and with Dr. Mitch, and you were saying this was just on the side, and yet I'm thinking this is so important. So how on the side is it? It sounds like it's a big part of everything because it also bleeds into what we were just talking about.
You're right. So for my full-time job with Steelcase, we work with a lot of organizations analyzing data sets, starting to look at behaviors and patterns of how people actually work. So we look at, sometimes like badge or sensors, or look at patterns. But what I realized is that when we're talking about wellness and the impact on people, there's a biometric of the individual experience that happens at the same time. And I think a lot of times organizations, they can look at general pattern sets, but they can't really ask you to share your biometrics with people. So when Natalie and I started connecting, we started talking about the biometric study, I realized this was another way for me to really start to understand the human experience from the individual level, from a performance level, individual level, and start to really look at the human behavior impact. And hopefully this learning from the biometric study can feed back into the corporate world, and we can start to really understand how do people feel, what's happening, right? So that's why I'm so passionate about doing this work.
So it could you explain a little bit about what that this work is?
Yes. So biometric study started with Natalie Bonin, and she's an amazing performer, and she's been thinking doing this for over 4 to 5 years now. But essentially, she's a violinist and performer, wanting to understand how music can impact people. So she did this video where she had EEG headsets with her family and recorded, her performing and how it's impacting their brain, and has been trying to grow this. So when we met up, I told her about my work in the corporate realm and wellness and interests and the experience and data. We started pairing up to create the first biometric study along with Robert Behidri, who's a another incredible person. So for the first study, the three of us hosted a series of hour-long breath work, which is led by Robert, violin performance led by Natalie, and my role was more around creating the survey design, data synthesis, and the experience. So we got a group of people together to starting to see how these different healing modalities impacted their body. And for our first phase, we had just asked people to bring their own devices like Oura Ring, Apple Watches, et cetera, just to see what we can get from the feasibility of it all and the interests. And then we added in movement, we added in a sound bath, et cetera, just to see how different modalities start to impact your body differently. And that got a lot of interest, which grew into biometric study two, where we brought in Dr. Mitch and other scientists to start really looking at to expand the study, right? With heart rate variability and other data sets. And we are growing to phase three, where we're taking that further to start to look at essentially making the invisible visible, and then adding another layer to the performance. So more than just a typical performer audience relationship, we're adding another dimension where the biometrics of a certain group of the audience will impact the art behind the performance in the screen. So now imagine at least three dimension of experience, right? observing the observer, and the observer's biometric and reaction becomes the art itself. So the study is just keeps on growing, and it's becoming really beautiful.
This is great, and the practical applications are kind of obvious, but relating to what we were talking about before are.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're just really looking at, people's nervous system becomes part of the experience, and the audience becomes the art. So really helping people to understand the impact of performances and healing modalities and connection with each other and embodiment.
So I can understand where we can't hook up people like in a bullpen in an office to a bunch of things and watch their biometrics on the screen. However, those of us who are a little bit more sensitive to energies or feelings, we could feel like when somebody walks into a room and the whole energy goes down or there's this weird hush. Do you know what I mean? And then that affects not only productivity, but it also affects people's moods and then how they leave or how they want or not want to come back to work.
It definitely does. And I think, going back to kind of what I learned with my grandfather, and it's a lot your body. We our body are tools and sensors, right? We're able to, like you said, sense other people's energies, sense what's happening, have intuitions before our brain can catch up to it. So a lot of that relational dynamic is very interesting to study. And I think for the biometric study, the data helps people to understand and visualize and create a different level of performance. But also, I think it inspires people to, after the fact, be more in tune with their own bodies. So for me, I did get an aura ring for the biometric study, but after watching the data for a certain amount of time, I became more in tune with my own reactions and how I was feeling and how the data was proving it. And after a while, I don't need it anymore. I can still use it, but that's the point, right? It's just to gain curiosity for you to be more aware, but you don't have to rely on that forever.
It's interesting how, in a sense, we're back bouncing back and forth from the group, the corporation, the office, the people there, to ourselves, and then back, and then ourselves. And so it's not about just us, it's not about the whole group that there has to be that interplay. And one of your main points, I think, is that we have to know first where we are, or who we are, or where we are, or what we are, why we are. What do we have to know? What are we doing?
Feel like for me, if anything, I've learned, like you said, the pendulum from me to we, right? From myself to my team to the organization, and you can apply that to communities, etc. But at the end of the day, I think it's really pausing, and asking yourself after every experience, how do I feel and what do I need? And building that relationship with your body and listening to it and learning how to communicate with it and what is it trying to say. And then the more self-awareness you have, the more you're able to be more in tune with the group and et cetera. So the work, I think, is still internal, the work we have to do with ourselves.
So I feel like there's an actual experience there, an actual question that we could ask ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. How do I feel and what do I need?
Just asking that.
Yeah. Pausing, making the time to do that before and after every experience.
So when we're going into a meeting, when we're walking into the office, when we're leaving the office at night, with our families or our loved ones, right? You're saying
Yeah.
take a moment to talk to ourselves, ask ourselves a question.
Yes. Before and after every interaction, every person you meet, every meeting you have, every trip you travel to, I think the more we pause throughout the day and just connect with our own bodies, the more we can be in tune with others around us. And understanding, like you said, how can our energy influence other people around me? And also sometimes not letting other people's energy infiltrate ourselves.
So if we were really honest with ourselves, or if we could really hear what ourselves is thinking, we might say, I'm being needy right now. Now we might not have the opportunity to fix that right away. So maybe knowing that, like, we know that that's going to affect the situation, right?
Right. Yeah. Being like, oh, this is how I feel right now. And maybe this is not the time to express, or maybe I need a moment to step away. All of that. And even just thinking about what's actually happening to our body, because there's so many different types of rejuvenation and work. And I think it's just really understanding what you need.
And what about thinking about the other person or the group or that you're walking into? Like, how can we think of them or to support?
So one of the things I started in my wellness research, I started looking at different types of, and this is a little bit divergent, but different types of rest. And I started realizing there's more than just one, right? A lot of times we think there's physical, mental, emotional. Through this TED Talk that I watched, I realized there might be seven different types of rest. So including creative, sensory, social, and spiritual. And I expanded on that work to start understanding what are the symptoms. So, for instance, for sensory, I might be overstimulated, distracted, avoidant. Whereas if I was more needing more social rest, I might be withdrawing and needing isolation, et cetera. So, first step after you start to sift through your own body to say, how much, what am I doing? What's happening with me? And what kind of rest do I need? Then, before you go into any social setting or connection, you can just communicate to say, hey, maybe my social battery is really low right now. So this is how much I can give and what I need. So when you're aware of where you are, you can start to understand what is it that you need right now and for other people to understand. So in a way of communication, and I think even just having that language to talk about it, right? So people don't misunderstand to say, hey, child looks really angry today. What's happening? And I'm just socially worn out. I'm really low battery, but letting you know that then they won't misunderstand and take it personally. So, understanding
Nice.
yourself and what you need, and then communicating that with others so they can understand, and finding the right time to collaborate as needed, right? But also giving each other permission to say, I know we had this time set, but I'm just not in a place to, I don't have any creative battery left. So is it okay if we schedule to tomorrow when I can be more productive? So instead of
Nice.
burning out and doing things just because we feel like we have to, but really be more aware and communicating what you need. So when you are together, it's more productive.
Nice. And what about part of the experience that you are having with Nathalie is the music, right? So if she has recorded music, maybe people can listen to if they know that this music helps in a certain way. Or for that matter, Davy Nathan. They can listen to Davy Nathan's music if they appreciate and can warm up to that kind of music. So music, I would imagine, or talking to the people that we like, or calling a friend, hey, I'm about to go into a meeting and I just wanted to, say thanks for being my friend because you always calm me down or something. How does that work?
Exactly. So going back to the seven types of rest and expanding on that, right? Understanding what is it that you need, understanding what activities could charge you back, bring you back into balance, and understanding what sort of support you need, whether it is cultural or space or communication or et cetera. So for someone, Natalie's music might be very activating. For someone else, it might not be, or it might, hit them in a different way. So again, I think it starts with understanding yourself and what is that you need. And we're, as the researchers, we're looking at research, one size doesn't fit all. And a lot of large organizations are starting to look at the uniqueness of individuals, neurodiversity levels, sensitivity levels, where they are in life. And there's a lot of different factors into influencing what people need.
So much to learn. You have so many more years of sharing this information, and I can't wait for the next level. This is great. Thank you for coming on and sharing as you have. And I want to give the audience a good way for them to connect with you and your work, and of course with the work that you're talking about. Now, people can find you on Instagram, of course, at it's just your name. Oh, well, no, actually, what is chaos.kura? Real quickly.
So Chao, my name is Chao, and I realize if you add an S, it becomes chaos. So it's chaos.kura.
Here. I was trying to be too clever. I didn't want to say chaos. Okay. And no, what is that?
Chaos Kura, it goes back into the curating chaos, right? So curation, chaos curation. And I realized if you look at the root of the word cura, it also means to cure or to heal. So to me is healing through chaos. And I think the world, we're in constant flux and the only constant is change. So embracing it and welcoming it. And for me, the purpose is to heal. So to heal as many as possible through play, through embodiment, through joy, and all of the learnings and discoveries that I'm embarking on.
Okay. Well, that's chaos.kura, C-U-R-A, or is it O? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And before we end here, I will spell your name. So Chao, C-H-A-O, and then Do, D-O-U. And I use Chao a lot here on the show from my Italian heritage. And you just gave me a new meaning, because in Chinese or Mandarin, right? What does it mean?
Yeah, Chao in Mandarin means super or to surpass.
That is brilliant. I like it even more now. Well, you've got a great name. Chao, this has been so great.
Thank you. It was so wonderful chatting with you.
Likewise. Look forward to the next time.
All right.
What a brilliant.
Takes Chao Chao to a whole new level.
It does. Chao, everyone. Totally. It's brilliant. And she's brilliant. And I love this connection with Nathalie and Dr. Mitch. And who
it's
knows?
It's a powerhouse team. Robert Behedri. And then we had a guest workshop with Chris Tai. And just so many beautiful people. Mitch and Jody are really leading the way with some fantastic studies on coherence. And Natalie's just a visionary way beyond her performance abilities. She's a visionary. She's a tech visionary. There's just so much coming together, and it's starting to take a life of its own on, which is really fabulous.
And to have somebody like Chao, who collects data and analyzes it and then uses it in a design way, in an artistic way, because she's also an artist herself, and then bring it into the workforce. It's needed everywhere.
Well, that's the whole point, right? Is it's a consciousness shift, because it really is all connected. And I'm also excited that we have another tagline. We can just say chaos, the only constant.
Nice. Well, we'll look forward to more conversation. I was going to say
more
chaos.
Look forward to
Chao, everyone. Okay, so with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Alana, and I need some help. Several of my friends have recently lost their pets that they have shared their lives for 15 or more years together. They are absolutely devastated and are falling into deep depression. How can I help them move through their loss more easily?
Dearest Alana, what your friends are experiencing is real grief. When someone has shared daily life, routines, comfort, and unconditional love with a pet for 15 plus years, the loss can feel as profound as losing a family member. There is nothing lesser about this kind of grief, and trying to hurry it away often makes it heavier. I have discovered that the most helpful thing one can offer is companionship through the grief, not a way around it. I believe that what matters more than anything is for us to validate the depth of their loss. Many people grieving pets feel isolated because society often minimizes their pain. You can help by acknowledging their pain through the words you speak, sharing helpful phrases like, Your grief makes sense. You didn't just lose a pet, you lost a relationship. Your precious pet was a part of your daily life and your heart. So, of course, this hurts deeply. And you can tell your friends that you are here for them through this time of grieving. Validation helps prevent grief from turning into depression. It is helpful to let them talk about their pet often and repeatedly. I have discovered that shared grief softens the pain of loss, and so I encourage my friends to share stories and to look at photos or videos of their beloved pets. It also helps if you talk about the pet's personality, habits, and special gifts they share with all who experience their presence. And please continue the loving support for as long as it is needed. And let's remember that we don't need to try to fix their pain. Being there for them is the best we can do. So please let them know that you are here for them and that you admire their love and affection for their dear friends.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And for our performance segment, we have a pianist, a songwriter, and a producer, is David Nathan. Welcome, Davey, to the Life Changes Show.
Hey, thank you, y'all. Good to be here.
Davey, it's great to have you. And before we get into depth of your story, I was thinking of you while speaking with Chow in the sense that you work in your studio and almost 24/7, I'm sure, but and sometimes or most of the time by yourself. Can you feel the energy when somebody walks in the room and like equipment changes or works better or doesn't work? Or do you get those sensations?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually prefer to work with other people in the room. So even if it's someone sitting on the couch, there's something about that. You know, having another person in there, it just makes the music better.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I actually prefer that.
Well, that's interesting because we're going to talk in a little bit about a song that's very special to all of us. But what I was there for that song, and we'll talk about it in a little bit. But after a while, I thought, I wonder if, you know, we all should go, because at one point there were several of us. I wonder.
Right.
But is it sometimes the more the merrier, or you just need one person?
No, it's one person's enough.
Okay. So, when did you start with music, or when did you know that you had started with music?
Right. So I mean, my mom says that when I was one, I was all about music at that age. And then there's pictures of me at 2 years old playing piano, guitar, accordion, and singing around the house. But I started lessons officially when I was six. And I was very, very quickly, I was giving concerts. So I'm from Israel originally. So this was in the 80s. And I was like giving concerts all around the country.
Oh, soon after six or?
Yeah, six, seven, eight, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And that was my thing. I never played sports. I just played music.
So you've had a very interesting musical career. As a matter of fact, I was looking through your very, very, very short bio that you sent us.
Okay.
And I thought, I already know like 20 more people he's worked with that are not on this list.
Right.
So that are big names. I mean,
I honestly forget. I forget sometimes.
You forget.
Yeah.
Wow, I think you're being modest. I think you're just modest. You're like, here's a couple of people I've worked with.
Right.
But wow, I mean, what a list you have. And so the journey has been very interesting. So when you were giving concerts, before we get into that, it was on the keyboards, I take it?
Yeah, I started playing organ, like an electronic organ.
Wow.
My childhood and teenage years. And I got into piano later, like when I was 16, 17. And I discovered jazz at 17. And I was hooked. I was like a jazz nerd, you know, practicing 6, 7 hours a day. I was just, that was my whole life.
You still practice.
I do. I do. I love practicing. I love the piano. It's, you know, I think other than my parents, it's the longest relationship I'll ever have. And it's just always there. I think with all our technological advances in the world, I think the piano is the most complex thing. I'm still like in awe of it, and it's still like a beast that, you know, I know so much about, and I don't know so much about.
You know, this whole time while I've been thinking of you, kind of like the picture you sent of you, you're at the keyboard. But when you say piano, you mean the grand piano,
That's
right?
right. That's right.
Wow.
I love synthesizers, but I love them as well, and I like the organ as well. But the piano is just it's just the number one for me.
You know, thank you for saying that. This just touched my heart because I had an organ. My parents got me an organ as a kid, which was wonderful and all that, but I always wanted a piano and they couldn't understand. It's like that you could do so much more with an organ. I know it's the piano, the acoustics. It's so what is it for you?
What is it about the piano? Well, the nerdy answer to that is that and why not, right?
Oh, go, you go.
On a synthesizer or a keyboard, every note is sampled, right? So it's like a snapshot of what it's supposed to be, right? When so you can sample a piano, you can sample every note, you can sample it 20 times for different velocities. But when you play two notes together on a piano, something happens in there, and you can't sample that. So let alone, you know, eight notes together. And so it's just like the resonances, and it's just a living, breathing instrument, and the wood and the strings and you know, I just love it so much, and the velocities. Lately, I've been working on like micro velocities. It's so hard, even for me. I've been playing 40 years, you know. So yeah,
Wow.
I keep discovering it. I think it's the hardest instrument to play.
Wow. Wow, because there are a lot of people that would argue that. You know what? I think I'm about to get nerdy down there with you, and I think we probably need to bring it back to a song or something. And there is more I want to talk about with your career that's fascinating, because there's something else you love that plays into this. But let's talk about this first song, and it's special, I said earlier, to all of us because first of all, we got to meet you because of our friend and contributing producer, Tess Cacciatore, who worked with you and is working with you because you are is it the musical director or what are you? Yes, you're the musical director of Yumi's Universe, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
you've been a part of the whole Yumi project since the beginning musically, and you wrote music. She wrote the lyrics for this song. And what is the name of the song?
Legends of the Light.
Legends of the Light. And so let's see, there's Abuela Marta on it, and there's Malu Beauvoir, who we've had on the show. There's Dr. Marty Casey, who we've also had on the show. There's Joan Ryan, and then there's Mark Lejeur, who is our executive producer and co-host, and there is I, there's moi, and you recorded us all together, and we're gonna get to hear actually what the very first time ever in the world premiere, universe premiere.
Love it.
Is there anything you want to say about the piece before we air?
Well, I met Tess. This is all thanks to Stevie Wonder, believe it or not.
Oh,
I met Tess
right.
at Stevie Wonder's birthday party, and very random. And yeah, she told me that she wrote this children's book, and she was looking for songs. And I was like, Count me in. And this is the third song that we have written. And it just comes so easy, I think, because of the story and the world that she created, and just the way that her and I work together. It's like she comes over, she has the lyrics, and we just, it's just, I don't even know how it happens, but after a couple of hours, we have a song.
Nice. Nice. Well, this song, at least the portion that I was definitely a part of, and I've certainly heard stories along the way, is certainly a labor of love, and I think people are gonna feel that.
Yes.
So here is Legend of the Light by Davey Nathan and Tess Cacciatore for world premiere here on the Life Changes Show.
Keepers of the flame, you're the legends of the light. The mountain and desert will brighten up our night. Don't ever break the chain, hold my hand, we'll unite. You're the keepers of the flame, you're the legends of the keepers of the flame, you're the legends of the light. The mountain and desert will brighten up our night. Don't ever break the chain, hold my hand, we'll unite. You're the keepers of the flame, you're the keepers of the flame, you're the legends of the light. The mountain
sueltes mi mano, somos la unidad. Kailashka.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. I had not heard this version. Tess sent it to me, but I didn't want to hear it until I got to hear it together with all of us. Wow.
Cool, right?
Davey, Nathan.
It's a
Awesome.
whole world, isn't it?
It's a whole world. Tess Cacciatore, awesome. Good on you both. Very exciting. Wow. Yeah. Yumi's Universe and Legend of the Light, and congratulations. This is very exciting. And it Let's let people know how they can also connect with you. Davy Nathan, Davy Nathan, NathanN.com is Davy Nathan's website, and he's Davy Nathan on Instagram. He's got so much music out there. We even have a link to one of his albums. That's an instrumental album. We have that on the webpage for Davy Nathan at the Life Changes Show. So check that out as well as his short bio that doesn't include a hundredth of the people he's worked with names that you would know. But speaking of names that you would know, you have toured with so many people as their musical director or their keyboardist or both. So many people for how many years?
For 10 years.
10 years.
Years of touring, yes.
And what was that like?
Yeah. So touring was awesome. I started with Brian McKnight, which was amazing. He's still one of my favorite musicians I've ever worked with.
Who's not on the list, by the way, in your bio?
He's not. That's right. I started with Brian, and I was 24 at the time. That was incredible. And then it's actually a cool story. I moved to LA. I drove from Boston. I was living in Boston, and I drove from Boston to LA in 2005. There was no GPS yet, so just straight up map. And I got here, and then the next day I called a friend of mine who's a musical director that I knew. And 2 days later, I was on the Leno show with Patti LaBelle. 2 days later. And that clip is still on YouTube.
With who?
Patti LaBelle.
Oh, wow.
Legend. And I started, so that was Wednesday, and then my first gig with her was 2 days later on Friday, and I started playing with her. And what was funny about that is that I was the third keyboard player on stage, and she didn't even notice me until like the third night. She didn't even see that I was on stage. There was so much going on. But after a couple of months, I graduated to the second keyboard player.
Yeah, she saw you for sure.
Yeah, and then I became the musical director.
And there it is.
at 25, and that was
wow.
That was really school, wow. You know, in many ways. So I played with her, and then I met Tony Braxton. I was her pianist and musical director for 10 years.
Wow.
I worked. I'm reading from my website. So I worked. I worked with Christina Aguilera for many years, and Babyface, who is my favorite, Kobe Calais, Natasha Bedingfield, New Kids on the Block. I was with them every summer for like 7 years. Wow. They're amazing. Nicole Scherzinger, Jason Derulo, and I also did for the jazz nerds. I did a tour with Stanley Clark, who is a jazz legend.
Yeah, wow.
I toured with him as well. So I did all that in 10 years. And at the same time, I was living in LA, and I had my own shows, and I played on the show X Factor. I did a couple of seasons of that as a pianist. And I was working with all the artists there. And yeah, I just did a lot.
You had all that going on. You had a place in LA. What didn't you have in LA?
What didn't I have?
You said you didn't have furniture.
Oh, that's right. I didn't have furniture for the longest time because I was never home. I was on tour 10 months out of the year.
Okay. So the funny thing to me was that a lot of people say when somebody wants to become a musician, a lot of people say, keep your day job. Right. Now, you had probably the coolest day job for 10 years that any musician, well, many musicians would dream of having.
Mm-hmm.
And you let go of your day job.
I did.
For what?
To write and produce full time.
And so, did you know how to?
No. It's an interesting thing because I was writing songs that whole time, but I wasn't really good at it. Or maybe I was good, but I wasn't great at it. But I knew that this is what I should be doing. And you know what it was? It was like I had this little voice in my head. Every time I achieved something, whether it was, playing with, a big show with Christina Aguilera or being on TV or playing in front of 100,000 people. Like every time I would achieve one of these things, I had a little voice in my head saying, "Yeah, but that's not why I moved to this country." So I was playing all these shows and it was amazing, but I felt like that's 10% of what I can do. That's 10% of my talent. I could do much more. Although I wasn't good at it yet, but I knew that if I had the chance, I could do it, or I could learn how to do it.
Is that what you told yourself when you came here, that I'm coming to America to write music?
No.
You just knew that that wasn't it. Seeing performing in front of 100,000 people and being on national TV, you knew that wasn't that.
Yeah,
Okay.
I had to do it to realize that that wasn't it.
Okay.
You know what I'm
Okay.
saying? Like, I just wanted to be a musician, since I was a kid. I just wanted to work. And the first concert, I was just talking about this. The first concert I ever saw was Michael Jackson came to Israel in 91. And I remember seeing that concert as a kid, and I wanted to be in the band. So I think that was kind of like my North Star. I just wanted to get to that level. But then once I got there, I was like, okay, I get it. That's great, but I can do more. And
Now I want Michael Jackson singing my songs.
right, exactly. Because, I never got bored. Like, with Toni Braxton, I was with her for 10 years. I always enjoyed playing Unbreak My Heart. I always did, But I was like, I can do more than just this. But the way that I think the music industry is when people know you for one thing, that's all they're gonna call you for. So with Toni, for example, I was her musical director, I was her live piano player. So she would call me for that. If she was in the studio, she wouldn't call me definitely not write a song for her.
Wow, yeah.
Right. So I had
Wow.
to change. I knew I had to change how people saw me. Because if they saw me on stage, then it's like, okay, he does that.
Right.
So
Well,
I.
because most people do only, I mean,
Yes.
as far as taking it to that level,
Yeah.
but now you've taken this to this level so much so that, oh wait, now I don't know if you told me a story that we're not going to talk about.
We can.
The one that you turned something, the
I
one,
did. I
okay,
did.
we're going to talk
So,
about that?
sure, no problem. So, this is a tell-all interview. So, I quit playing professionally about 11 years ago. I had to just stop completely. I had even, when I wasn't on tour, I would play around town. I had my own show and everything. So, I sold all the keyboards I had, and I just like, I'm like, I'm done, I'm out. And
Wait, sold all the keyboards? You have a whole wall full of keyboards.
I know I do now.
Oh, okay.
But back then it was like keyboards that I would gig with,
Okay.
So I was like, I have to go into this like writing and production. I have to do it 100%, just all day. This is what I'm gonna do now. And I gotta be honest, at first it was very tough. Like the first year was very tough because I was still getting calls for tours. I think up like 2 years even after I stopped. But the story we were talking about was that 2 years ago, I got called for a tour after, 8 or 9 years of not having toured. And it was with Beyonce. It was,
Well,
Beyonce was about to start rehearsals for the Renaissance tour. And a friend of mine is the musical director, and he said, he's like, I know you don't play anymore, but we got this thing if you want to do it. I
we
think he
got this
called
thing.
yeah I
We
think he
got this
called me
thing. the biggest thing in pop music.
Yeah. I think he called me on a Thursday and rehearsal started Monday.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And so because it was Beyonce, I said, you know what, let me just sleep on it. But I knew I was going to say no. So yeah, I called him in the morning and I said, I'm saying no to the biggest pop star on the planet.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a commitment. What and honorable too. And you obviously got good, you got great, and you have since had many sing your songs and right? I mean, we talked about you working with Usher, and we talked about was it Chaka Khan and Josh Groban? I mean, wow. And Netflix, and let's talk Jingle Jangle.
Yes. So in 2018, I got a call to write songs for a new movie musical on Netflix. And my writing partner and I, Philip Lawrence is his name, we started writing for this movie. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. We had never made a movie before, never written a musical before. But we connected with the director who also wrote the story, David Talbert. We connected with him so much that the three of us were just like, let's figure this out together. And so that started a three-year journey, which was into the pandemic as well. Like the pandemic started, but we were deep in this movie. So yeah, 3 years we worked on this thing. I lived in London for 6 months because we shot in London. And yeah, it's the biggest thing I've ever done. I'm very proud of it. It came out on Netflix in 2020. It was number one in like 76 countries for 2 weeks, translated to 32 languages.
Oh.
And it's a Christmas story. So every Christmas it comes back, and it's become a classic to so many people. And it's really cool that sometimes I travel, I meet people from all over the world who've seen it and love it. And then people who haven't seen it, like they watch it and they're like, oh my God, this is so amazing. So,
congrats. That's exciting.
Yeah. Really, really special project. And it stars Forest Whitaker and Felicia Rashad and Keegan-Michael Key and Ricky Martin. And it was really cool to work with Forest Whitaker, who had never sang on camera before. So it's his first time singing. And he was a voice major in college, he told us. So it was so cool to work with him and, you know, for him to sing one of our songs. And, you know, it was incredible.
Incredible. Well, good for you. Well, speaking of never having sung before, so this song I did listen to, and I listened to from front to back and then again, and I was enjoying it, and I didn't know who this was that you were working with, but I figured it was somebody that you were working with. Are we able to say who it is that you were working with on this song? No, that's not what I meant. I meant, are we able to say who I thought? No. Can we say who it is?
Yeah, of course. I see.
Can we say it's you?
Yes.
It blew me away.
Thanks.
So how, like, what can we say about it?
So I am not a singer. I'm a pianist. But, you know, as a songwriter, I do sing. Like in my studio, I write melodies and lyrics. And so I do sing. And I have gotten songs like sold with my voice, which I think just speaks to how good the songs are. Gentle flex, humble flex, right? But yeah, this song, I was working with an artist, a gospel artist. And it was one day that I was supposed to come into the studio in the afternoon. And they texted me that morning and they said, actually, don't come until tonight. So now I had like 5 hours to kill. And I was just like, let me try to write something. And I wrote this song. This song just came out of me. I wrote it probably in half an hour. And then I was like, I have to present it to him somehow. So let me just record it. And so I recorded it. And you'll hear most of the song is actually vocals. There's a lot of background vocals. So I recorded all of them, and then I recorded the lead. And yeah, it was funny. I went into the studio that night, and I go into this huge studio, and there's like 30 people in there, all amazing writers and producers and incredible singers. And I'm like, hey, I wrote a little song. And I had to play it in front of them. But the artist loved it, and he recorded it, and he's performed it since. He has not released it yet, his version of it. But yeah, you'll get to hear my original demo with my
So
voice.
this is exciting because it's a world premiere of your song and maybe even a world premiere of your singing.
Oh, for sure.
Oh,
So I'm waiting
wow.
for the record deals just to pile up in my mailbox
Well, right
after.
after we play it. So
Yeah.
interesting too that Legends of the Light was the song that we just played. And While My Light Is On
Is on, yeah.
is the title of this song, written and performed by Davey Nathan, premiered here on the Life Changes Show.
When I look out on the ocean and I try to take it in, the water reminds me where I am now and where I've been. I used to walk in the darkness, but the day is still long, so I better start living while my light is on, while my light is on, while my light is on. Yeah, I better start living while my light is on. I've been thinking about fathers, I've been thinking about sons, I've been thinking about forever and the day that just begun. I've been thinking about glory and all my friends who are gone, and so I better start living while my light is on, while my light is on, while my light is on. Yeah, I better start living while my light is on. Yeah, I've been thinking about freedom and the things I want to change. Will I get to where I'm going and what's behind my name? Will I make it to 100? Will I write the perfect song? So I better start living while my light is on. I better start living while my light is on. While my light is on. I better start living. Light is on.
Davey Nathan,
Hello.
while my light is on, I'm so glad your light is on, and it is so on. And it sounds like you're living, hopefully having as good a time as it sounds from what you've shared. More power to you. I want to remind everybody, Davey Nathan, DavyNathan on Instagram or davynathan.com. Davey, we're going to be hearing a lot more of your music, and thank you for sharing it here on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me, man. This is awesome.
It's been great, and your stories are great, and it sounds like there'll be more, there already are more stories for sure,
Yeah.
but there will
Absolutely.
be more. Until next time, Davey, all the best to you.
Same to you. Thanks, guys.
It's been such a pleasure. So with a big thank you to to Davey Nathan, and another big thank you to our interview guest, Chow Do. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeune, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.